Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a great episode lined up for you tonight as we kind of head in towards the holidays here and wrap up our year. And we're going to be talking with a brand new guest who's actually part of the family here on the show. We'll get on into that here in just a sec. But before we can get to anybody else, we, of course, have to talk to dog lover extraordinaire Sam Bradley.
Well, there's a lot of dog lovers on this show, and we're going to be talking to them. We have both our meteorologists with us tonight. We have Becky, who's listening in, and she loves dogs, too. And we have Kyle. I don't think he has a dog, but, you know, he moves around too much. But after that, we're going to talk to Joe Holly, our famous Dr. Joe, and Joe Holly's better half, if I might say, Kimberly, and we're going to talk about dogs a little bit more. So first I want to throw it to Kyle, though. We had a lot of issues in Illinois here recently. I mean, kind of mind-boggling, a number of tornadoes. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely, Sam, and hello to everyone on the podcast. Sorry I've been away for a little bit, but night shift does weird things to your recording schedule. I do want to take this time to just give a quick shout out to Becky and thank her for helping out with the podcast and the weather segment side of things. So, but we'll be working in tandem going forward. So huge shout out to Becky.
Well, thanks. I'm just happy to be on and learn so much.
Heck yeah. All right. Well, Sam, those Illinois tornadoes, I'll tell you what, though. Just to start off, tornadoes in December, and these occurred on December 1st of this year, they're actually not terribly rare. The United States actually has a second, but less potent, if you will, peak in tornado activity during the mid to late fall, and that's typically seen further in the southern and southeastern United States as opposed to the peak in early spring, late spring and early summer, which is your more typical tornado alley, so the central plains and on up into the Midwest. But these tornadoes that you're talking about, based on National Weather Service surveys, they've surveyed at least 28 tornadoes so far, the most significant of which was an EF3 tornado that tore through the city of Taylorville in Christensen County, Illinois. And now, despite the unusual time of year, this storm was actually very well predicted, and the efforts from both local folks as well as the National Weather Service provided over 41 minutes of lead time to the folks in Taylorville in advance of this storm. And it was absolutely incredible, even though there were close to two dozen fatalities, I'm sure more now since the report was published. No fatalities have been reported, which is an incredible testament to a late season tornado outbreak in western and central Illinois.
Kyle, just want to real quick correct you. You said fatalities, but you meant injuries, but no fatalities, correct?
Yes, I'm at the end of a week. I'm sorry.
It's all right. I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly, because I wasn't sure if you I hadn't heard there were any fatalities, but you meant there were numerous injuries, but no fatalities.
Absolutely, Jamie. So numerous injuries, close to two dozen, but no fatalities, which is absolutely incredible. So hats off to the folks from the local, regional, and state levels, and at the federal level as well, for helping to keep those communities safe, prepared, and informed both before and during these storms. So for the setup of this, kind of how it all unfolded, so for tornadoes, just to kind of set the stage here, you need four key ingredients, and that's moisture. So moisture in the air, again, on those very muggy days, you can feel it. Instability, so we're talking about warmer air near the surface with cooler air as you go higher up in the atmosphere. That warmer air near the surface is less dense and it wants to rise. So that's an unstable situation. Lift is the third ingredient, and that can be either generated by terrain features like we typically see out in the western and the eastern United States. But here in Illinois, it was actually a front that moved through, so kind of forcing that unstable air to start to rise and start off this whole process. And on a typical day, that can give us our garden variety thunderstorms, but it was the vertical wind shear, that key fourth ingredient, where winds are changing speed and direction as you go from the surface up through the atmosphere. And that's what causes those storms to rotate. And as those storms start to rotate, they can then produce tornadoes. So on December 1st, we had all those ingredients in place in central Illinois. And in the afternoon hours, those storms began to fire off, and they grew very, very quickly. And it was actually, there were two main supercell thunderstorms, which are the big monster thunderstorms with rotating updrafts. And as those tracked to the north and northeast from the Illinois-Missouri line into western and central Missouri, those supercells actually produced multiple tornadoes. And that's what we call a cyclic supercell. And that's where it's not just one and done, but the storm could actually persist and produce multiple tornadoes as it travels along its path. And one of those tornadoes, that was the one that occurred and moved into the Taylorville area. And what likely saved many, many lives was a group of storm spotters, our Skywarn spotters, who go out and observe and report back their sightings of severe weather to the National Weather Service and local emergency management. They were able to detect the tornado not just on radar, but have that visual ground truth confirmation from the spotters. And the National Weather Service was able to issue a tornado emergency. So not just a tornado warning, but a tornado emergency, saying that there is a confirmed tornado that's very damaging and destructive, and it's moving towards a largely populated area that is Taylorville, Illinois. Once that was issued, that gave them ample lead time to take shelter and take those protective actions and help to limit the injuries and keep those fatalities at zero for this event. And just to kind of bring this to a close here, once that Taylorville tornado dissipated, its parent supercell went on to produce more tornadoes along its path, and it lasted a total of 3 hours. So just goes to show you that no matter what the time of year, even into early parts of December, if the ingredients are in place, you can have a very destructive tornado event.
So always be prepared. Becky, anything you want to add to that real quick?
No, I think Kyle covered it really, really well. I really want to hit home the point that tornadoes can happen any time of year, pretty much anywhere. So never let your guard down and always be paying attention to the forecast and have a way to receive alerts and warnings, because as Kyle stated, there were no fatalities and clearly lives were saved because of the forecast and the warnings that were issued.
And like both of you said before, always pay attention to your local news. They'll know best. Your local weather folks will know best about what's going on in the area. So let's go on to something a little more fun. We got Dr. Joe and Dr. Joe's Kimberly Holly. We've mentioned her a number of times, but, you know, they're dog people like we're all dog people, but she's taken it up a notch. Kimberly is actually starting to train a search and rescue dog. So, Kimberly, I'd love to know how you even got interested in this and what is the process for preparing yourself and preparing your dog?
Well, hey, Sam and everybody, thanks so much for having me on. I'm very excited to be on. I've been listening to these podcasts for a long time, and I may be biased because my husband's on here, but I do think you do a brilliant job, all of you. And I don't even know that I'm worthy to be on here, but I'm certainly honored and glad to join you. I guess I would start by saying my background started in the rescue world. I became very passionate about fostering and working with local shelters. Here in the Southeast, and particularly in West Tennessee, we have such an overpopulation of homeless animals, and it just became a passion of mine to try to help as many as I could. And thankfully, I have a husband who was always willing to take the next one in and the next one in. And generally, I didn't ask him. I just showed up with one, and he was very tolerant and would help me put the kennels back together. And that's how it really got started. And I think through that passion of wanting to save more and help more, I sort of immersed myself in larger scale rescues and disaster response for animals. I took a lot of online courses and got involved in some more national groups like the ASPCA and the Humane Society of the United States, all who offer excellent education online if that's something that you're passionate about. And so I had begun to take those classes and learn more about rescuing animals in large scale disaster, which sort of segued into my current position, which is I am training to be to become part of the Tennessee Task Force Urban Search and Rescue Team, and within that group, part of the canine search team. So it really started just from a love of animals and wanting to learn as much about them and further my education and my knowledge.
So, Kimberly, I have to ask. We've heard that when Joe goes off on a long deployment, he comes home to another animal. Is that true?
Well, it is. When Joe is at Hurricane Harvey, which was about 2 weeks, which is just about enough time for me to make bad decisions, I did wander into the Humane Society and showed back up with a cat, who is famously known as Batman, and he is our house cat. He's very much in charge, and we just work for him. And there have been other times in Joe's travels where he has come home to an animal that he did not know would be there when he got home. most of those did not stick around. They were just fosters, and we found permanent homes for them. So,
well, what about your new dog, the one you're training now? Tell us about that one.
Well, so about 2 weeks ago, we brought home Cooper. Cooper is a full-blooded black lab. He was originally trained as a gun dog, and for different reasons, being a hunting dog didn't really work out for Cooper. But he has a tremendous sense of smell. He's very smart. He knows his directions, and he knows his commands quite well, which has turned into what we hope will be an ideal situation for a search and rescue dog. Cooper is being trained specifically in live search and live victim search. He doesn't seem to have an affinity very much for human remains detection. And each of the dogs that we train on the team, we will put in one of those two specialties. Those dogs that do human remains don't do live search, and the team really needs to be made up of all of them, because when they go on deployment and when they are responding, it's in the process of deployment, it's hard to know what the situation and what the conditions will be like when the dogs get there, and the team has to be ready to respond accordingly. So that's Cooper's training, and that's what he and I are both working on together. So we're both rookies at this time.
Well, I assume there are certain tests you have to put a dog through to find out what affinity they have or not, you know, whether they'd be better for searching for live people versus cadavers and so forth, correct?
Well, absolutely. So in the USAR system, they are very, somewhat particular about breed in general. And the breeds that tend to work out best for search and rescue, whether it's human remains or live victim, are Labradors, Golden Retrievers, Belgian Malinois, Border Collies, and German Shepherds. So in most situations, you will see members of the team, members of the canine team, in one of those, as one of those breeds. Once a dog is selected, and that selection process can either come when they are very young as puppies, and many come from certain breeders and certain bloodlines that they know make excellent search dogs, and can also be found in older young adults that are over the age of one. Sometimes that's a little bit easier because you're able to detect whether or not they have a good drive and that love of play and everything that's needed. But once a dog is selected, yes, there's so many different things that they have to know and they have to be able to do. Simple things like food aggression and aggression to other dogs, aggression to other people, immediately will rule them out before they get a chance to do anything else. And then from there, of course, there's a list of skills and abilities that they have to have in order to be certified on the team and stay on the team.
Excellent. Well, before we talk about the human training, Jamie, any thoughts?
No, I was going to ask a question about, you know, which dogs are better, because you often hear about labs being trained for these types of activities. And I don't know if it's a temperament thing or if there are specific breeds that are more more positively trained for these types of specific types of resources or not. But I think she kind of touched on that. So I'll let it go unless there's anything else you can add to that, Kimberly.
Well, I do know that as a rookie, and I call myself that for so many reasons, but Deborah Burnett, who is the head of the canine team for the Tennessee Task Force and who has trained dogs her entire career and has dogs that she has trained throughout the USAR system, she made it very clear to me that if I wanted to work with her, I would start with a Labrador. And not one of the Belgian Malinois. And as she put it, Kimberly, you will need to learn how to drive a Cadillac before you can learn how to drive a Ferrari. And that's her mentality on the different breeds. They definitely, the Malinois have such an intensity and drive that it truly takes someone. And as much as I think I know about dogs, it takes a very experienced handler to work with them. And as she has explained to me, the Labradors tend to put up with a little more, have a little bit more forgiveness in their handlers, and will keep doing the job as needed.
And then, of course, you have to remember how to say Malinois. So
that too, of course.
So, Becky, you're a dog person. Any thoughts from you?
No, I've just been listening. I'm fascinated by the various dog breeds that are most useful. I mean, I assumed retrievers would be one, but I hadn't even heard of the other dogs, so it's fascinating.
I wonder if there's such a thing as weather dogs. You know anything about that, Kyle?
Oh, Sam, weather dogs, you know, my favorite kind of weather dog is a sun dog.
Ooh.
So now sun dogs. Yes.
One that hangs out in the sun?
Well, one that actually forms due to the sun and how it bends the light off of ice crystals. So you might see it in the wintertime. You'll have typically in the morning hours, you'll see it when the sun angle is pretty low. So you'll have kind of a bright kind of dot in the skies with the sun. There might be a halo around it, and then you'll see two bright spots to either side. And that's a sun dog. So think of the sun in the middle. See the dog knows. We're talking about the sun dog. So we got the big bright spot in the middle. That's a dog's nose. The bright spots on the sides are the ears. It's one of my favorite things to ride up the chairlift and see in the mornings on the mountain.
You're such a silly boy. So, Joe, we haven't heard from you. You're sitting in the background there. What do you think about all of this that she's doing?
I just think, yes, dear.
Smart man. So Kimberly, what did you have to do to prepare for training your dog? I assume something came along prior to actually working with the dog.
Well, let me start by saying I did receive a certification online through the Animal Behavior Institute. This was a couple of years back. On just basic canine training and behavior, which I think gave me a good background in different training methods and what might work for dogs. But I really did, I sought that education more as maybe as a second career when I left the hospital world, and to help friends who had dogs that maybe had some behavioral problems. It really seemed to be more pet-driven, which was my interest there, especially with rescue dogs, helping dogs that may have some behavioral issues overcome those so that they're more likely to find a home. But I did get that background and that knowledge, and that has helped quite a bit. Although I will say, the training and the work that is done, it's. For the USAR dogs, for those that are learning search and rescue, it is it is something that once the dog learns it, you don't stop training. The training is constant. It's ongoing. That is their career. That's their job. And the dogs really need that practice and that ongoing perfection of their skills. So it's a bit different than the way you would treat a pet and their training.
Jamie, you had a question.
Ah, I pulled a Joe. I couldn't unmute myself.
hey.
Anyway, no, I had a question for you, Kimberly. As you're going through the training, because it's an ongoing process, as you just said, what is something that really caught you by surprise that you didn't expect? Maybe either a happy occurrence or something that you realized you really needed to step up and learn something new.
I think for me, becoming a part of this team, and there was so much talk about how hard this team works, how hard the canine team works. And I do think that part of me thought that once these dogs have this skill, that they have it, and then they just go and live their lives and wait for deployment like everyone else. It's all about perspective. When you think about the guys and women that make up the task force across the country, they perfect their skills every day when they're riding in the back of an ambulance or responding to a fire or whatever other job it is that they do in their daily life. They're constantly perfecting their skills. And these dogs need that as well. They need the constant exposure to human remain scent. They need the constant exposure to agility training and walking on unpleasant surfaces. Just because they know it and they can do it, that has to be driven home for them, just like as if it were their career, whether there's a deployment or not. And I don't think I appreciated how hard these canine teams work. And how much these dogs are treated as an equal member of the team.
Probably not a good idea to take one of them into Dr. Joe and Paragon's cadaver lab. But on the other hand, maybe that's a good opportunity for training. I don't know. What do you think, Joe?
Oh, there's no question. We can. We're happy to incorporate them into that training. You know, one of the responsibilities of the medical team on a USAR task force is care of the dogs. So we have to brush up our veterinary skills and our ability to assess an animal and take care of common issues that we see in the field related to the work that they're doing.
Very cool. Yeah, that actually would be, incorporate them in some of your experiential training. That would be a great idea. So, Kimberly, how long does it take to, do you think, to get a dog ready to be certified?
So generally the training for a dog, it can start from the time that they're a puppy, but they really need to be at least a year and a half old before they're even considered for the team for things like temperament and maturity. Also to make sure that they are cleared for any health or muscular issues that could develop. But the training itself, at least a year and a half of really consistent, really high quality training. Training as a part of a team with other dogs, with other handlers, to make sure that when they are in a deployment situation, they can respond to any situations that come to them. My training specifically for me is, as I am not, I don't have a medical background. I'm not a first responder. I am what is considered a civilian member of the team. My training will also take about a year to complete all of the online and in-person courses that I have to complete. So, and then Cooper and I will have courses that we have to do together. And so it's a team effort, not just for the canine, but for the handler as well.
So needless to say, it takes a lot of dedication and a lot of time and you have to really want to do it. And I know people that have actually taken off on their jobs because of the intensity of the time that's involved in dog training.
It is. I was surprised by that. And I think another big element of it, and as I look at Cooper laying in front of my fireplace, and he's such a cool dude. The biggest element, the most important element, is how the dog and the handler respond to one another. I am very new to this, and I know that despite how I feel about Cooper as a dog, and I do like him a lot, it may be decided that I'm not the best handler for him or that he's not the best canine for me. And all of us, dogs and handlers, have our own unique characteristics and what we bring to a site, what we bring to the situation. It could be determined at some point that Cooper and I don't make a good team, at which point our team leaders will make a change and may switch things around, may move dogs to different handlers. So it's not pet ownership as much as it is a partnership, and they just happen to live with you.
Well, on that note, does Joe have to treat him differently, being as he has to identify with you and treat him like the other pets you have, correct?
Well, yes, and not just Joe, but my children as well. So we have three children that live here in our house. And from the minute that Cooper came home, I had to make sure that not only Joe, but the kids realize they have to treat him a bit differently. So for instance, Cooper works for toys. When we are out working and he does an exercise well, he gets rewarded with a game of tug of war or we'll go after a toy. And that's how he is trained. We try not to introduce too much food rewards out in the field because those food rewards can create scents out there that will disrupt what the dog needs to be searching for. So those toy rewards are really important. My kids are used to playing with our other dogs and throwing the ball for them and doing those types of things. And every time I see them with a ball or something headed towards Cooper, I have to stop them and remind them he can't play with that. He can chew on a bone. He can chew on those kinds of things, but he can't get toys for free. He has to work for toys. And I think another thing about dogs is, and our team leaders made it very clear, as soon as you bring a dog into the home, they'll immediately start negotiating with you. And, well, maybe I can just put my foot on the couch. Well, now I'm going to put both my two front feet on the couch. I'm going to get my whole body on the couch. And those kinds of negotiations that happen with our pets can't really happen with these working dogs. They have to understand their place because they will be expected to behave in very specific ways on a deployment.
Yeah, it's got to be a little tough when you have the other dogs around. Kyle, you had a question.
Yes. I was curious, Kimberly, with training your dog for USAR duties, I know you talked a lot about training the dog to respond to you and to kind of be one with the dog and recognize each other, but is there an aspect where the dogs are trained to recognize the uniforms of someone in USAR so that if perhaps you weren't available and there was another handler that was wearing a similar uniform, the dog would recognize that person as a person of authority versus just keying off of your voice?
I'm not aware of training specifically to recognize the uniform. However, the dogs that are part of the team, especially the younger dogs that are part of the team, often whoever that handler is that keeps them at their house, the ones that they live with, will pass them off to other members, others of us on the team, to do particular exercises and to work with them. So that those dogs, as they develop and they move throughout the system to other task forces, they can easily transition to any handler that picks up their leash. The to respond specifically about uniforms, that's not a thing that I'm aware of that the dogs are taught. However, when we do training, many times we'll have quote-unquote victims hidden in a field, and we'll have other observers around walking, just as there would be in a deployment situation. And as long as you are upright and you're standing, the dog knows to disregard you. And the dog is looking for anybody that may be, you know, on the ground or sitting down or, you know, otherwise in a different position than upright. So that is one thing that they know to, if they pick up your scent and you're standing upright, they're not concerned about you, and they'll keep moving and keep hunting.
There's a lot of other people out there that are maybe thinking about doing this, and I guess they need to realize how much work there actually is. So, Jamie, I'm going to throw it back to you. Any thoughts on your part?
No, I just think this is fascinating. And you know, Kimberly, I think what we'd like to do is maybe as the process continues to progress, have you on and maybe give us some updates from time to time on how things are going, new lessons you've learned. You know, things like that, and how Cooper's doing and his training as well. It's too bad we can't ask him a question.
Well, you can't, because right now he's got his head in Joe's lap and Joe's rubbing on him he's trying to get him to bark and talk to us. You know, I think as a member of the canine team, quit trying to make the dog talk. As a member of the,
I hear Joe barking.
Yeah, that's Joe barking. There are so many different things that I have to train on, things like swift water awareness, structural collapse, confined space awareness, things that didn't really occur to me when I signed on to work with dogs, because that was my passion, and also, of course, helping people. But as a civilian member of the team, learning all of those things has been really fascinating and quite an education that I don't think I expected to get. So I would be happy to come on anytime and tell you about our progress, and hopefully we keep progressing and doing well together.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. And Joe, you know, I know you've done a lot of different types of training with Paragon and worked out some different ways for, you know, your students to train. I'm sure you've worked dogs into those training scenarios as well, correct?
Yeah, we certainly have. You know, everything from bomb detection dogs to the search and rescue dogs. So, you know, there's a little bit different set of skills with each of those. And I think for a lot of folks that are involved in the training, they are not engaged enough in the dog aspect of it to appreciate the subtle but significant differences between how those animals are trained and how people need to interact with them. You know, it's a natural tendency to want to go up and pet the dog and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's part of the educational process for those folks that are involved in the search and rescue world, to appreciate how to utilize that tool like you do any other tool, how to take care of it and how to use it properly.
Well, I think that, you know, it's just another example of the customizable training that Paragon does, and the way that you can adapt a specific scenario and set of skills to be taught to every system out there. So if someone wants to reach out to you and ask that question of how can Paragon help us, what can you bring to our system that to help our responders be better prepared, where can they reach out to you?
Well, we'd absolutely love to talk to folks. It is a very customizable experience, and they can always reach us through our website at paragonmedicalgroup.com or through Facebook. Just search for Paragon Medical Group. And always to the Disaster Podcast.
And thank you for having Kimberly on the show. Kimberly, thank you for coming on the show. It's great to have you. And like I said, the invitation is always open.
Well, thank you, Cooper, and I enjoyed it very much.
Awesome. Becky, where can folks find you?
So I'm usually hanging out on Twitter. You can find me at WX_Bex or just search Becky D. Podwin. And I also hang out on the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. Have some good conversations there as well.
Yeah, we've had some good things posted over there recently, and I know you and Kyle and some others have all been really commenting a lot, and that's what we like to see. So I'm excited to see everybody participating, and if you have a weather question for Becky or Kyle, you know, make sure you put the post over there and link and get the answers to things you want to know about. That's what we're here for. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media places under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to follow along on Twitter and Instagram or connect with me on LinkedIn to continue the conversation.
Excellent. And it's great to have you back on the show. Nice to record this on a little bit different night so that you're available. So thanks for being available.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, I'll be there with Becky and Kyle on Twitter and Facebook and all the rest of them under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in the Facebook group, which is continually growing. And hopefully we'll get Kimberly to pop in there once in a while because there may be some questions related to this. And on the disasterpodcast.com website. How about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there, and we do love to connect with people, so please reach out to us, specifically over at our Facebook group. That seems to be our best community environment for folks, as well as over at disasterpodcast.com, where you can actually find the links and means to subscribe to this podcast on whatever device you prefer to reach out to us on. But definitely connect with us over on our Facebook group. And we want to look forward to having all of you join us over there and get the updates and continue the conversation with the rest of us. So Sam, this has been a great topic. I'm so glad we did this. And I know we've got some more coming up on USAR dogs, perhaps in the future soon. But this has been a fantastic subject tonight.
Yeah, and it, we're going into year 6, Jamie. Hard to believe, but we've certainly never run out of topics, and we have a lot of really good stuff coming up, so I'm looking forward to the new year. But this is just another perfect example. Disaster training is not our everyday training.